Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business, and I'm having a conversation today with Richard Meeran, who is the head of litigation at Lee and Day, the law firm, and they have had several cases in the past, including PLC and Shell, in which they have worked hard at corporate accountability and seeking justice for victims. So thank you for joining us, Richard, to talk about litigation and the state of litigation with regard to corporate accountability as we look at the key concerns for the year 2018. My first question is that where are we today, historically speaking, in terms of litigation? Because we still have huge burdens and barriers in the elusive search for remedy.
Well, this whole area has transformed since I first became involved in multinational litigation 25 years ago. For a start, the notion that a corporation could have human rights responsibilities wasn't recognized then, and obviously things have completely changed as far as that goes. As far as litigation is concerned, I'm focusing on the UK litigation. We have, over the years, faced two main challenges consistently, in relation to which, through our cases, the law, UK law, that is, has developed positively. I think just to explain the context is that we've brought cases in England due to a perceived lack of access to justice locally. But obviously, in order for a UK court to have jurisdiction, we generally have to sue the parent company, which is domiciled in the UK, over which the UK courts have jurisdiction. And that is what gives rise to these two obstacles, forum non convenience and the so-called corporate veil. And on the forum non convenience issue, just going back to the 1990s when we did the Cape PLC case, the 7,500 South African asbestos victims, the forum dispute, so this is a dispute in which the company argued that the South African courts were the more appropriate forum. That forum dispute lasted several years, and during that time, 1,000 of the 7,500 clients died. So that was incredibly unjust and sad. Now, as a result of that case and an earlier case that we did against Rio Tinto for a Namibian miner called Edward Connolly, the law in the UK on forum non-convenience was substantially improved from victims' perspective. What the courts decided in those cases was that even though the local courts may be the more appropriate venue, that the cases could nevertheless proceed in England where substantial justice would be denied by not allowing them to do so. So the specific areas that were focused on by the courts were inability of claimants in local courts to obtain legal representation and expert assistance for were undoubtedly very complex and significant cases. So that was by 2000 that had improved. In 2005, we had the ECJ decision in the Owusu case, which ruled that where a defendant was domiciled in the European Union, forum non-convenience could not be applied at all. So subsequent to that, it has meant that the multinational cases in the UK have progressed much more speedily. So we see there with the Trafigura, Shell, Monterico cases that there were no such jurisdictional challenges. And so the cases progress more speedily, as I say. On the corporate veil question, so this is the problem of shareholders, which parent companies are, not being liable by virtue of their shareholding for the conduct or the actions of subsidiaries. That was a problem that was recognized right from the outset. And so all these cases have been approached in a different way. They've been approached as tort law cases in which it was alleged that there was a breach of a duty of care owed directly by the multinational parent company in relation to the functions for which it was responsible at its local operations, and deficiencies in which functions then led to the harm. So we've always approached those cases as cases of direct liability of the parent company, not that the parent company was liable for the conduct of subsidiaries, but mm-hmm. it was liable for its own conduct. And so all those cases were pursued in the 1990s and thereafter on that basis. And then that culminated in the Chandler and Cape PLC decision, which I think was in 2011-2012, where the UK Court of Appeal held that a parent company could, in principle, owe a legal duty of care in relation to subsidiary operations. And the essential features had to be that there was a foreseeability of harm, a degree of control over key functions by mm-hmm. the parent, and a reliance by the subsidiary on superior knowledge of the parent. So that was a really important decision. And it's an approach, actually, which very recently has been applied again by the Court of Appeal in the case we've been running against Vedanta for Zambian environmental claimants. And what that case also demonstrates is that the Chandler principle is not something that is restricted to UK companies or to an occupational setting. It also applies in other situations where those features that I just mentioned arise. And the same approach of the parent company duty of care, the tort law approach, has also been utilised in the Netherlands in the Akpan case against Shell, and in the Hudbay Minerals case, which is currently ongoing in Canada as well. So these are all common law tort claims. But, I mean, a similar approach can also be taken using provisions of civil codes of other countries. So, for instance, in the Xstrata case that we are presently running, we are using provisions of the mm-hmm. Peruvian Civil Code to make very similar allegations about fault on the part of a parent company which had control over certain functions giving rise to harm.
Yeah, so one of the things...
So, you know, over this period, I think the point is, the upshot of this is that on these key issues over the past 25 years, we've come a long way. But there are still significant deficiencies and significant barriers.
It's those barriers that I wanted to turn to next, because one of the arguments that the advocates of the binding treaty for business and human rights are making, that argument is precisely to overcome the barriers. So what do you think should such a binding treaty cover?
Well, I think, first of all, that for practical reasons and just being pretty realistic about the situation, that the focus should be on access to remedy in multinational home state courts. And that is because the barriers are so huge at the moment in gaining access to justice in local courts. So home state courts, I think, should be the focus. And in that regard, there are serious legal, procedural and practical barriers to justice, including in the UK. And the combined effect of these is to deter lawyers from acting for claimants. You know, we're dealing in these cases with complex, resource-intensive mm-hmm. claims where the companies are represented invariably by an army of the top lawyers. And, you know, you've got claimants who can't afford to pay, where legal aid is not available. And so the victims' lawyers will be acting on some kind of contingency, faced with very formidable opposition, with these legal barriers that they have to cross, and having to run expensive litigation from their own pockets, which in turn gives rise to cash flow problems for the lawyers. So the combination of these things is really a massive disincentive for claimants' lawyers, which explains why there are so few of us who are doing these cases at present. So, turning to a binding treaty, the key thing is that the binding treaty needs to include provisions that increase the incentives on claimants' lawyers to take on these cases and to represent claimants. So, first of all, in those places where forum non conveniens can be utilized by defendants, that possibility needs to be removed. So, for instance, in countries such as Canada, Australia, the United States, they have forum non convenience, which is a significant barrier. The corporate veil, I've mentioned the progress that's been made in the UK there, but that's not progress that has occurred around the world. And what the UN guiding principles deal with is this human rights due diligence duty, which is similar to a common law duty of care. Now, that would be a significant advantage if there was a legally binding treaty which worldwide imposed a human rights due diligence duty on parent companies. That would be a significant boost. On the practical level, access to internal corporate documents is absolutely crucial. Whether a duty of care is imposed automatically or not, claimants are going to need evidence of the relationship between the parent and the subsidiary company in order to demonstrate that the parent company had the requisite degree of control, which gave rise to the duty to take effective steps to assess the extent to which that duty was properly complied with. Now, you know, the UK has quite effective discovery disclosure procedures, but they're very expensive. Some other countries also have effective procedures, but even where they've got those, they're problematic. In the Monterico case, there's a case for Peruvian environmental claimants that we did a few years ago. Only 7 documents in the possession of the Peruvian subsidiary were disclosed. So, you know, despite having effective disclosure procedures in England, that's what we got. It was clearly inadequate and only a very small proportion of the relevant documents. Other countries have very limited disclosure procedures, for instance, in the Netherlands and Germany, which is very problematic for claimants. And so one of the suggestions that's been made, which sounds like a very good one, is that there should be a reversal of the burden of proof in international corporate accountability cases, which requires the company concerned to prove that it was not in control of the activities of subsidiaries and subcontractors. So in that way, if the company is not being very forthcoming with documents, then it's at its own risk because the control will be assumed unless it can demonstrate using its documents to the contrary. So I think that would be very important as well. Class action procedures are another important consideration. They have those in certain countries, proper class actions, opt-out class actions. You have them in South Africa, Canada, the US, Australia. In England, we only have group actions, which are not quite the same. But the important point is that where you've got a large number of claimants whose claims individually may not be worth that much in financial terms, it's vital that they are able to form a collective action to proceed as a group in order to ensure that a case is financially viable. Class action is also important where you've got statute of limitations, because once the representative claim is instituted, it means that the limitation period is protected for the class as a whole, rather than each individual having to start a claim. Adverse costs is a problem in certain jurisdictions, again in the UK, for instance, where if a claimant loses or a party that loses has to pay the winner's costs. Now, some people might think that because victims in these human rights cases tend to be impoverished, that doesn't matter. But that's not true because, you know, from my experience, even people who have a small amount of money or a small piece of land or very little assets are anxious for those not to be put at risk. So abolition of the adverse costs risk is another important goal. And just finally, on damages, in Europe, we have the Rome II regulation, which stipulates that damages will be assessed at local levels where the victims live and where the harm occurred, rather. Now, that I think, creates a potential problem of double standards, because it means that victims suffering the same harm in a developed country will receive much higher damages than victims living in a developing country, and that may create an incentive for double standards.
Richard, you've spoken a fair bit on the situation in common law countries, particularly the UK and Canadian and Australian situation. Now, the US had a remedy, or at least people thought there was a remedy, which was the Alien Tort Statute. And of course, then the Keogh Bell judgment happened. And of course, there's a long-standing case in India involving another American company, which is, of course, Union Carbide and Bhopal. Bearing in mind that, would you offer some reflections on those phenomena?
Well, until the Keogh Bell case, the Alien Tort Statute was probably the main source of hope for multinational accountability. But as a result of Keogh Bell and other cases that have followed it, the future potential of the Alien Tort Statute in these types of cases, I think, is in considerable doubt. And that being the case, what is likely to happen is that future cases in the US would need to be brought as tort claims. And as we know from the Bhopal litigation, which was run in New York many years ago, we would then be confronted with the significant hurdle of forum non convenience, which seems to be applied more stringently in the US than, for instance, in the UK or Canada.
Yeah. So, and bearing that in mind, clearly one of the needs that shows up is the need for better local systems and local access to justice. How do you think can we strengthen that?
In an ideal world, these cases should be pursued locally, and local legal systems should be developed to enable victims to get access to justice in these cases in their own courts. At present, unfortunately, I think that is very unrealistic. The obstacles to justice that I've mentioned that apply in the UK and Europe and the US and so on are infinitely greater in developing countries. You know, you've got multinationals which will have the same kind of armory at their disposal in the local courts. Victims who are very unlikely to be able to find local lawyers who can take on a case at all, let alone on a level playing field, a case of this type, and problems with the legal system's access to documents and delay and so on is just at the moment, I think, generally insurmountable obstacles. And we did do a case in South Africa, which I was involved in for 13 years, actually. That was a case for gold miners with silicosis who sued Anglo American and Anglo Gold. It was a case that we worked on in conjunction with the Legal Resources Center and other South African lawyers, which was ultimately settled, but it did go on for 13 years before that happened. So I think that illustrates the difficulties, even where you've got a developing country with an advanced legal system and one which was similar to ours. It was quite very, very challenging.
No, absolutely. But to look ahead and look, the very fact is that the treaty is going to take several years. If there is going to be a treaty, other efforts will have to continue, including litigation such as yours. So what would be the two or three things you would like to see reflected in the treaty so that the remedy gap is addressed?
Well, I think the three things are the human rights due diligence duty needs to be firmly entrenched so that we start off with the position that a parent company owes a duty of care, and The inquiry is then one of whether it breached the duty of care. The second important advance would be to reverse the burden of proof so that the onus is on the company to show that it was not in control, or that if it was in control, that it took reasonable steps to avoid harm. I think we need proper class action mechanisms which enable groups of people to bring claims in one case rather than individual claims. And there needs to be reform of costs rules, which first of all avoid claimants potentially being liable for costs if they lose, but secondly ensure that victims lawyers who have run cases on a contingency basis are able to recover their costs so that they are willing in future to take on other cases.
This is fascinating. It's going to be an area of great scrutiny and interest for everyone, and clearly one of the top 10 issues to watch out for as we go along. Wish you all the best with your work, Richard, and thanks very much.
Thank you.